Hello and welcome to R&R's Real Stories in Restoration. This sub-series of our Ask the Expert podcast shares the stories of the people in restoration and remediation from all corners and levels of the industry. I'm your host, Valerie King, R&R's Editor-in-Chief, and I am joined today by Jim Kowalski, owner and vice president of Kowalski Construction, Inc. This is a family-owned and operated restoration and repair company based in Arizona that was founded back in 1967. Jim is also president of the Restoration Affiliates Board, which is a national network of independently owned cleaning and restoration firms throughout the U.S., and that was founded in 2011. Thank you so much for joining me, Jim.
Valerie, I can't tell you how excited I am to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Jim. Back at you. Thanks for being here. All right. So research on what you do and what the company does suggests you wear multiple hats, to say the least. So let's start there. First, can you tell me about Kowalski Construction, the services the company offers, locations covered, customer profile, company size, that kind of spiel?
Absolutely, you bet. As you mentioned, we were founded by my father back in 1967. We're still locally owned and family operated. We are third generation, and we're excited about that because you don't see that very often. We do have six locations, but don't let that impress you too much. They're all within a square mile. We are based in Phoenix, and we service all size jobs in the Phoenix metro area and do large loss throughout the state of Arizona. And then we'll cover emergency mitigation losses in any adjoining state, except for California, where we have no interest in working over there. So that's our footprint. We primarily focus on property managers, risk managers, owners, municipalities, agents and adjusters that need emergency and full restoration services. But we're particularly focused on those clients that value relationships, who want a reliable contractor at a fair price. We are not the bottom line, lowest priced guys out there. That's not our approach. We've been in business a long time, and we know what it takes to stay in business and operate. And unfortunately, not everybody does. And so we can't play the price game as a result of that.
Very, very helpful. So now on to Kowalski Construction. In terms of the work you do, can you talk about the services you offer a little bit more?
Yeah, this is where it gets a little bit confusing, because we operate we're one company, but we operate as multiple divisions. And so we break things down in groups that sort of make sense for us. So we do commercial restoration, but we also have commercial non-restoration for rehab and remodeling type work for many of our clients. We also have a commercial small loss division. Running the small losses is a lot different than running a large loss. And so we break that up. We do the residential, we lump that together. So our restoration and our non-restoration work is all in one division. We have a structure drying and mitigation division. We have a hazmat division for hazardous materials. We have contents, we do our own textiles in-house. We have an electrical installation division that services our Kowalski jobs as well as services our customers for their jobs, and an electrical service department that just does a lot of the service work. And then we own the local franchise for 1-800 Board Up as well.
Wow, that's impressive. I'm excited to dive a little bit more into scaling across those different verticals a little bit later on. But before that, on to you personally, what role do you play? Obviously you're owner, every owner kind of takes on different roles and focus areas. So what role do you play as owner of Kowalski Construction? Kind of your high level objectives and your more tangible responsibilities.
So this, I think, is a great question. My staff is probably eagerly waiting to find out what is it that I really do. So we have been a part of the entrepreneurial operating system program for many years now. And my first and foremost role is the visionary. And that came from that program to help us move forward. My brother, who's my partner, he's our integrator. And so we make a great team because we both have complementary skill sets. I focus on networking, and that's with clients, suppliers, vendors, strategic partners, typically at a high level. I focus on the company culture, which in our company is the primary, most important thing that we can present out there is our company culture. But on a tangible day-to-day, I oversee the marketing, the business development, the customer service, as well as IT.
Very good. Okay. So stepping sort of away from the company itself, I'm curious about restoration affiliates for myself and others who aren't familiar. So what is Restoration Affiliates? A franchisor, a third-party administrator? What does it mean to be a member or an affiliate?
That's a great question. And I tell a lot of people that we're the best-kept secret in the industry. So for somebody who's been around for almost 10 years and has as many companies and as big a footprint as we have, not a lot of people know much about us. So if you're okay with it, I'm going to take you a little bit of a history tour to show you how Restoration Affiliates came about. So like many restoration companies, my brother and I have been involved in peer network groups for 25 plus years. And there's a lot of good groups out there. You got business networks, business mentors, Violand, and then of course Pivot. And so these groups typically take companies in non-competing markets. And this is not where you get together over a cocktail and you talk about restoration. This is an intense program where we go and visit their facilities, we interview their people, we inspect their facilities, we review their financial statements, their SOPs. We come up with, as a group, suggestions to help that company become even a better company than they already are. And then we assign accountability, we assign a timeline, and they have to then report back to us on their progress. And oh, by the way, if they don't comply, there's penalties that are being assessed, because this is not just casual suggestions. Each group comes, each company, and they pay their own way. They're on their own dime to come and help this company. The cool part about it is we've never gone to help a company where we haven't been helped ourselves, where we haven't learned things ourselves. So for years, we've been involved in this process, and it's a great program. I highly recommend it. And during that process, we got to know a lot of restoration companies really well. So somebody would come to us and say, hey, do you know a company? Can you guys service this claim for us in this other state? Well, I can't, but I know a company really, really well that I think would take care of you. So we've been referring work back and forth informally. Then fast forward to today's climate. You've got mergers and acquisitions. You got the regional players becoming national players, everybody gobbling each other up. And the climate has changed. The landscape has changed. So we got together a group and said, you know what? We think we're you know, the game in town, but we're the only in town. We're not out of town. So what can we do to help provide better service for our clients that might need services in other areas that we don't provide? So we kind of got together and we talked about this idea and started small with a small group and sort of grew it into a little bit bigger group. And the fact is that we started to be able to service clients in other areas, but that wasn't the whole point of it. The point of it was to continue to utilize it. I call it the brain trust, right? It's a co-op is what it is. So we can advertise together. We can do marketing. We can attend events and trade shows together. We can do things that each of us individually can only do a part of, but collectively we can do a lot. So for instance, our organization is going to attend 6 national trade shows this month. I can't go to 6 trade shows this month, but we as a group can do it, so we can all help each other. And it's a volunteer organization, so we're all in, contribute what we can and participate. And we have a couple of things that we really believe that we have to continue to hammer home with our members. And one is treat every Restoration Affiliates referral as if it was your best customer. If I'm going to refer my customer to you, I've got to have high confidence you're going to take good care of them. And then, because we have so much talent in the group, we treat every Restoration Affiliates member's employee as if it was our own. So if somebody calls with a question or reaches out on the forum or through email, they are immediately received by a group of people that are trying to help them, provide input, and help them sort of do a better job at what they're doing. So we have a very strict vetting process, because the way that it works is each member owns one share of the parent company equally. So it's not a pyramid scheme. So if we have a new member come in, I get a vote, he gets a vote. So I have to really be careful about, it's not just some, we don't want dots on the map. I was a membership chair for years. And of course, we see these other companies growing and expanding, and there's this sense of urgency. We've got to get bigger. We've got to have more locations. I say we want to have the right locations. We want to have the right members. It's so important because they get a vote, I get a vote. We're all in it together. And so the be able to work with the companies that closely, growth will come, but we don't want to grow so quickly that we implode, which is what I see happen sometimes with companies. So we do, it is a peer network group. It is a referral process. It is a co-op. It is for procurement. We do purchasing through the group and things like that. So it's a combination of all of those things. But I always caution people not to join restoration affiliates because they want to get more work. It's not all about just the referrals. It's a lot more than that.
Thank you so much, Jim. That really is helpful. A lot of great context, and also just examples like going to a trade event soon and you can't make it. Like very tangible examples of different benefits to belonging to the organization. So as president, what is your role as president of the RA board? What do you focus on?
So can you imagine, we are focusing on what we feel are the premier restoration companies that are independently owned and operated in major markets. So we have a lot of talent, a lot of strong personalities. And so my role is to get them all to play nice in the sandbox, right? I mean, seriously, they have to balance their organizational goals, short-term and long-term, against the industry and our group as an organization, its goals. And so we have sometimes where we sort of compete with marketplace, we kind of overlap a little bit, and it's just getting everybody to figure out how to make it work and to continue moving forward for the best interest of us all. And that can sometimes be rather challenging, but that's what I see my primary more role down there as.
Very helpful. Yeah, you definitely wear multiple hats. That ends that theme of the introduction to the interview, but no shortage of things that you're focused on a daily basis. All right, so now I'm curious, back to yourself, but before joining the restoration industry, at least officially. So looking at your background, can you give us an overview of your journey to restoration? Obviously, the company's a family company. I'm assuming there's a bit of a tie there, but yeah, how'd you get to the industry and kind of what was your journey even through it, looking at where you are today?
So I was born into the restoration industry. So I literally grew up in it. And when I first was getting paid for helping my dad, I earned 50 cents a week was I got paid. And I want you to know, my dad got every cent out of it. He got his money's worth for sure. And my older brother and I, we would clean the equipment when it would come back at the end of the day from the cruise. And that was our job. And so when I eventually graduated to go to work into the warehouse, oh, can you imagine what a dollar per hour felt like? I thought I was the richest kid on the planet. And so I grew up then working in the warehouse and doing those sort of things. So I've been doing restoration full-time, 40 plus hours a week, as if there was a 40-hour work week anymore. We keep saying that, but for 42 years now. So I've been in it full time. And prior to that, I've always been in it. So I tell everybody, we've got to be successful with this because it's the only thing I know how to do. I would be in serious trouble if I had to go out and find another job somewhere. So we've got to make a go of it. So really and truly, I do say I was born into it, grew up in it, and am still doing it.
Very good. Okay. So layering onto that, like we talked about, Kowalski Construction is a third generation family run business. So I'm super curious, what has kept you family owned and led all of this time, especially in an environment like you talked about of increased consolidation and franchises and moving away from that? What's kept it this way?
That's a great question. Because as you mentioned, there's been unprecedented consolidation. I used to keep a file folder that I called a competitors gone defunct. And I would make a little list of every time a competitor went out of business and I would write it down. And I remember early on, my wife used to say, oh, they're out of business. So that means more work for you. And I would reply, no, for every one that goes out of business, there'll be two more you know, that'll be starting up. And every company has to start up at some point in time. We were a startup as well, but all too often they just don't make it. And we've seen that over and over. And the file, I saved it electronically. Now I don't bother to try to maintain it anymore, but it was a large list of companies. And so it's a sad statement of affairs. And so it's almost a frenzy right now to buy companies. And we joke about it. We're disappointed if we don't at least get one phone call a week from somebody that wants to buy us, because that tells us, hey, we must be somebody. There's an interest out there. And that might be the right solution for some companies. And I'm not saying that it isn't, but for us, we're more of a legacy business. We're very family focused, family valued, and that's important to us. And we joke about, hey, someday they're all going to be consolidated. There'll be no family businesses left. So we'll be really, sought after, because we'll be different that way. But it's just, I think, a matter of choice for these companies. Unfortunately, what I think happens is restoration guys, they're always thinking right now, because it's what they're dealing with is right in front of their face. And so they don't oftentimes do any long-term planning, or maybe as much long-term planning as they should. So then after years, they wake up one morning, they look in the mirror and they realize they're approaching retirement age and they don't have a plan, because it's all been short-term planning. So I just encourage them to think more long-term. What is it that they want to do, so that they aren't doing something like maybe selling their business if that's not their desire, but they feel that's their only option to do. So for us, we've always tried to look long-term down the road, and that sort of seemed to be the best fit for us and what we wanted to do and where we want to go. And we're blessed to have a third generation working in the business now, that have been with us a long time and doing well and on the leadership team. So we feel like we've got a successful future awaiting for us.
Thanks for that, Jim. And also just your perspective on the industry, because yes, to your point, there's a lot of action and a lot of consolidation, and it makes being family owned and run, especially for such a long time, a bigger deal than it would have been otherwise. So in this industry. Adding on to that, you're a family-owned business, but as you started off, you're not this teeny tiny shop, and you're not just focusing on teeny tiny jobs. So, and you have a few divisions, to say the least. So what kind of work went into scaling the family business over the years? And are there key milestones you have in mind you could highlight in that growth journey?
That's a great question. So I think we used to grow less strategically than we do now. We've heard I can't remember who said it, but there's a famous quote, and it says that most businesses are apt to die from overfeeding than they are from starvation. And we all think that we have to grow and grow fast. And I say that in 2 years running now, we've made the Inc. 5000 top list. We're 98th fastest growing company in Arizona and the 211th fastest growing construction company in the country. So we are growing fast, continue to grow fast, but we really watch that, where some companies are not necessarily even focused on it. They just grow to grow. And oftentimes what we see happen is they implode. They can't sustain the growth. And so we went through some of those phases. We started off and we were heavily focused on contents, and we sold that division in the early 80s. I don't know the exact year, I don't remember, but it was a whole different era back then. And the way that contents were processed then and the way that they're done now is totally different. So we went through that phase. We had opened a flooring division. And when I say a flooring division, when the distributors had contests to see who bought the most flooring, we typically would win. So we were outpacing the flooring companies. We had our own roofing crews. We had two roofing crews that we were running full time. We had a cabinet shop. We started off because we were repairing cabinets that were water damaged and that sort of thing. And then we started building cabinets. We set up a whole cabinet shop and we were doing custom cabinets. We had a plumbing division. We were doing 3 repipes a day. That's pretty good for a construction company and not just a plumbing company, right? And so we saw that we were growing in different areas, and we were starting to provide service outside to other customers. And then we decided, you know what? We don't know that that's the best direction for us. We kind of pulled back and we've started focusing on more of the things that were closer to our core. And so while we still do these other services, they're part of our job. They're not our main focus. We had a Tucson location for many years. We had a Flagstaff location. At one time, we even turned into a software company. When we were networking, we were at an event down in the South. My brother and I were at a conference, and we bumped into a company down there, and we got talking to them about there was no project management software on the market. Now there's plenty of options. There were none. We were trying to create our own with a developer. We talked to this other company, and we found out they were trying to do the same thing. The good news was they made further advancements sort of on the production side, and ours was a little more advanced on the sales and the marketing side. We were both using the same platform, so we got together, we co-opted resources, and we started to work together. Well, you got to go way back and realize how expensive it was back then. It's not like it is today. And so developing the software was a huge investment. So we started working, and we needed more cash. We started talking with our peer network companies about what we were doing, and many of them wanted in. We ended up taking 10 partners in. And so that allowed us to fund the growth that we needed. And we developed the software. And we created the software. And now we have a software that we're all utilizing, but now it needed to be maintained. There was troubleshooting. So other companies started finding out about it, and they wanted in on it. All of a sudden, we hired a salesperson. Now we needed somebody to support the software and to continue to develop it. We had 3 people on staff that were working in support. We had a salesperson, and we were selling copies out in the industry. And we said, wait a minute, we're not a software company. What are we doing? So then we were approached by a company that said, hey, we'd like to buy your software. And we were a little surprised by this. Why? They said, because we really don't want it in the marketplace. And so we sold the software for no money, but for the opportunity to work with that company and utilize their software. And it was really a good marriage because they really were a software company and we weren't. And they knew that we were a strong resource. So we helped them to continue to develop the software and to grow it and make it more focused towards our industry so that it would be able to do the things that we needed to do. So we've gone from all over the place, from kind of focusing in individual markets to back to where we are, more of what we do today. And we're a construction company that does restoration, rehabs, remodeling, and those related services. And that's more what we focus on today.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that and going into detail there. I think that's such a great story in just refining your business and your focus over the years. And you don't hear that all the time about getting so big and then backing it up. Sometimes it's more about just trying to get big, or to your point, growing for the sake of growing, or different. But that's just a cool perspective with so many teachable takeaways for our listeners, I think, who are leading businesses and trying to purposefully guide them toward a growth that makes sense. So I like how you said closer to your core.
And I think that is so key, because like when we came to the conclusion that we were a large company, but really at the end of the day, was it really meeting our goals? And we realized that it wasn't. So we started to move towards closing down those divisions. Well, what happens then? The industry starts talking. They're going out of business. This is the end. All of that stuff we had to deal with. We opened our office down in Tucson. So we service all of Arizona for large loss. Well, we have a lot of clients down in Tucson, which is the second most populated city in Arizona. And they said, you know, we have all this work that you guys could do for us, but you only come down to do the large stuff. What you need to open up an office in Tucson so you can handle the small losses. So we did. Well, after years of operating it and reviewing and analyzing the numbers, we weren't doing enough small work there to justify another office location, because we could still handle the large loss from our location. We transfer people and we move people down and things like that, but we could do that without having a brick and mortar establishment down there. So we finally decided, you know what, this just isn't cost effective. We're going to close the Tucson office. And when we did, same thing happened again. The industry is all alive. They're going under, they're closing up, all that stuff. You got to do what's right for you and not worry about what the industry is going to say, and know that it's in your best interest and just stay true to your values and then move forward. And so I encourage companies to think about that. Think about their growth strategically. What makes sense for them? What services should they offer? There's a lot of excitement that can get generated around a new program or a new possibility. but really take a look at it and analyze it and see if it makes sense and decide for yourselves whether it's something you should pursue or not.
Thanks so much for that. So kind of tied into this, but almost in the other direction, you've grown, you've refocused, but you still have a substantial number of divisions, as we've talked about, construction and restoration, board up, electrical, mitigation. You must be finding value in those verticals, so to speak, as of today. So I'm just curious, can you speak to the value of having multiple divisions, which you highlighted earlier?
We're big believers in not putting all your eggs in one basket. And I tell people that with clients as well. We're always monitoring the amount of work that we're getting from any one particular client. We would never turn their work down, but it's something to monitor so that we can see that we can ensure that it doesn't become too large of a percentage. So years ago, here we are doing work for one of the insurance companies and everything is going great. And we get the phone call and the phone call goes something like this. Hey, we just called to let you know that you guys are off the list. What? What did we do wrong? Oh, you didn't do anything wrong. We love you guys. Well, then why aren't we on the list? Oh, our company signed a national agreement with this franchise company. And we can't use you anymore. What? There goes a big portion of our business immediately out the door. We said, oh, wake up call. Not going to let that happen again. So we really monitor that. What we want is we call it the multi-leg stool. We don't want to have anything wobbling on us. So if we're getting a lot of business from one particular client, we want to make sure that we're growing business in other areas, the same with our verticals. So we don't depend on just one of those areas of service. For whatever reason something should change, we have a steady platform from which we feel a solid foundation can be built on in order to ensure success in the future.
You talked about residential, you talked about commercial, you talked about different sizes of projects. So would you say your projects lean more residential or more commercial as of today?
To both. And here's the tricky part. The numbers in residential are higher. The dollars in commercial are way higher. We're currently working on a restoration project right now that is top $9 million and will probably likely hit 10 before we're done. And so it takes a lot of residential jobs to try to add up to that number. So by far, the numbers are heavily skewed residential, and by far the dollars are heavily skewed towards commercial.
In approaching residential versus commercial projects, do you feel like there are notable differences or, you know, overarching similarities or what's your take there?
We handle them differently. So we do, for residential work, we have a claims department model and that's how we function there. So we have claims people who are primarily in the office that are writing the estimates. We'll have our production staff go out and inspect the losses if needed. We typically will Matterport those losses. Then they'll oftentimes the estimator doesn't have to go out. That's our goal, is not to have them have to go out. If somebody has to go out, it's going to be somebody on the operations side that's going to end up running that job. So they'll then provide that feedback to the person in the claims department. On the commercial side, it's a little more complex. So the commercial estimators will go out and inspect those losses and then write those losses themselves. So we do approach residential and commercial differently because we think they're two different animals.
Thank you for that. Okay. So before we even held this interview and I was reaching out, you sent some really intriguing case studies my way. I know you guys invest awesomely in just kind of capturing stories of some of the projects you've done. So I'd love to highlight what stands out in your head. First, what is your most memorable residential project and why so?
So hands down, it was, we did Hugh Downs' home. He had a home here in Carefree. And I remember getting the call from my dad that there was a large loss at Hugh Downs' home and we were going to be heading that way. And as a world icon as he is, I had to think, who's that now? You know, it wasn't quite clicking. Of course, I saw the picture and immediately knew who he was. So we went out there and he had a flood at his home, a multi-story home, and it was quite extensive. And the reason that it was the most memorable for me, I was running the job at the time as a project manager. And I get a phone call late on a Friday afternoon from Hugh Downs himself. Now, up to this point, I met him at the house and then that was it. He actually had other people that I was working with on his staff, and he had hired an adjuster. And there we were working with all these other people, but not on his home, but not actually interacting with him. And I get a phone call from him. And I'm thinking to myself, uh-oh, what's wrong? And I pick up the phone and he says, hi, Jim. Just says, I just wanted to give you a call. And I knew that he traveled extensively. So I said, where are you? And he told me some far off place, Bora Bora or something. I don't remember. And he gets to talking and I'm thinking, when's he going to drop the shoe? When's he going to? And he says, I just wanted to take a few moments. I've been talking to my staff. I understand things are going well. And I want to thank you personally for doing the work at my house. And I'm thinking to myself, you've got to be kidding me. Because as busy as I think I am, I'm not as busy as Hugh Downs was. But he took the time to place a personal phone call and how much that meant to me that he did that. And that left a lasting impression on me that I always try to remember that, how important that personal contact can be and reach out and let people know when you think they're doing a good job.
What a great story. Thank you for that. I couldn't agree more. And yeah, just that lasting takeaway that you keep with you in your work, in your life. Very good. Okay, so same question, but tied to commercial. So what was your most memorable commercial project and why?
Very close correlation here. We got a call for one of the large regional hospitals in the Valley. They had a sewage loss. And the sewage loss occurred below the operating rooms in what they call their SPD. It's the sterile processing department. All these terms I wasn't familiar with. So the sewage loss occurred down below, and the sterile processing department was responsible for providing all the tools and equipment that are needed. Tools, I'm a construction guy, right? They probably don't call them tools in medical world, but anyways, all the instruments and the utensils that they need to sterilize it. Well, it had flooded, sewage had flooded the area. They send them up in elevators for the operating rooms. They told us back then that the operating rooms, if they were down for a day, would lose several hundred thousands of dollars per day. So that was paramount importance to them. And so we had to go out and have a meeting to talk about how we were going to do this sewage loss, which turned into a mold remediation. And oh yes, there was asbestos there that had to be dealt with at the same time. And they didn't want to shut down any operating time. So we had this meeting. There had to be 100 people together. And I'm sitting in this room and there, all these people are very strongly opinionated about what we should do and how we should do it, all from the hospital staff. And they're going back and forth and they're asking me questions and I'm feeling like I'm in the hot seat, right? And I'm thinking, what do you want me to do? I didn't cause this. I'm here to help you. You know, how are we going to do this? We can't do this. And throwing all this stuff out. And I hardly noticed him until he spoke, but there was a man sitting there sort of in the front and he kind of was like the thinker. He was like this. He wasn't really looking around and he wasn't saying anything. But when he spoke, the entire room stopped. It was kind of like E.F. Hutton. He spoke and everybody stopped. And I didn't realize he was the chief of staff. And so everybody was just out there. And then he started asking questions. And he asked questions from each of the departments. And he took order and made it from the chaos that was there by asking the questions. I don't think he had the answers, but he got to the answer by asking questions of all the people. And he got them to be able to talk about it. And we came up with a plan. We actually did the work. In 3 days, they don't operate on Fridays. So Friday morning, we tore everything out. We got everything going. By 8 o'clock, Monday morning, they were back in business. And this was just an incredible plan that we were able to put together when you brought everybody to the table that had a goal, the same goal in mind, and got them focused on the goal instead of the chaos and the concerns that were out there. So it was a tremendous experience and we were able to do it successfully. And I don't think if he'd have been there, we'd have come up with that had the opportunity to come up with a plan that would have worked. So it was really quite an eye-opening experience for me.
That's an awesome story, Jim. Yeah, I love the two, how they both experiences, it's the client's perspective in some way and their communication and their appreciation for the situation that kind of stands out to you most. Very cool. All right, so more on to projects, tools, as you talked about earlier. What tools do you consider most critical to your company's success? And I'm thinking business and or field side, whatever really stands out to you.
Terrific. So I encourage people to join a peer network group, get involved with industry associations, right? So many people are sort of running their own businesses isolated from the rest of the industry. And I think it's really important to be able to grow and to do that. For us, the EOS platform, the Entrepreneur Operating System, when we joined it, we weren't that familiar with it. We'd heard about it. Since then, we've run into several other companies, even in other industries, that have embraced it. It doesn't have to be that one for other companies. I'm sure there are plenty of good ones out there, but get into a program and then follow it. Utilize it as an opportunity for the leadership team to come together and speak a common language with a common goal and to be able to continue to move your company forward. We've always had strong partnerships with those in the industry that support our industry. And while we reach out to help them, they're able to help us. We were the first user in Arizona for Xactimate. Back in the day, Bill Loveland himself flew on a plane bringing a full desk-sized computer out to demo the product to us, okay? So young people would absolutely not understand that, but that's how it was back then. So we embraced the technology. We got on board with it. We created a relationship with them by providing feedback. I was the beta tester for them for many years. I would do work with them on training. I did their training videos. I worked with them on product development. We worked with them on the pricing team. And by helping them, they were able to help us and help us provide the tools that we needed as our own company, but also for the industry as a whole. And so all too often, people wait for the opportunity to come to them. And I encourage them to reach out. We work with NextGear. We have a monthly phone call with NextGear. We use both Dash and Luxor. And then we have a development and a support meeting where we talk about what enhancements we would like to see. And we rank them in order of importance so they can feedback to their team. And we utilize Sanctum to help our sales team with their training. So I tell people all the time, don't wait. I know you're busy. Everybody's busy, but there's so much value that you can provide to the industry and receive by getting involved and getting engaged. So I think the number one tool for us is engagement. It's almost therapeutic, and we share this with our staff. So our staff knows that if they have a question, then they can reach out to somebody in our restoration affiliates group who does that role, because I can help them, and I've done that role, but it was probably at a time when the business was very different. So I can guide them, I can help them, but it's really therapeutic for them to be able to talk to somebody doing the exact same job in a different market and speaks the same language and be able to help each other work through a situation that maybe they hadn't thought of before.
Thanks for that. All right, now for end of interview takeaways. I love this part. Okay, so what are your biggest challenges right now?
Staffing. And everybody says that. And every time I tell somebody, they say, oh, I know, it's tight all over. I am telling you, Phoenix, Arizona leads the country in construction year after year after year, over 20 years running. When you look at all the other cities, we're not number one every year, but over 20 years, we're the number one country. So construction in Phoenix is hot. And yes, it's tight all over, but it's really tough here. So with that in mind, you know, we can complain about it. We can do what we can, but we finally decided we've got to get serious with it. So we're putting our money where our mouth is. We're running recruiting ads more often. We've hired a full-time recruiter. We're doing job fairs, things that we have to step outside the box and do, because we're competing with all the other industries. And I hate to break this to you, but construction restoration is not the number one choice probably for most young people these days. So we've got to compete against maybe more favorable or perceived favorable, desirable occupations that, you know, that we are. So there's a lot of, I think a lot of people are in the same boat, but I encourage them, it's not hopeless. You know, you've got to get staff in order to do it. It's a challenge for everybody, but think outside the box and try to do something you haven't done before and see if that works for you.
Very good. Appreciate you sharing some things you're doing to help address this challenge that's so widely shared. Cool to know you brought on an in-house recruiter too. a serious investment, but I can imagine important. So
mm-hmm.
Very good. All right. So advice. What is your advice to others who are looking to launch their own restoration business? Of course, you have, you know, three generations behind you. You've got so much experience. You talked about scaling and refocusing. So all of that, what advice does that bring for those looking to do business in this industry?
So my number one advice is culture. And some consultant, I may not get the quote right. I think it might, no, I can't remember who it is. Anyways, he said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Find your culture, embrace your culture, and then make sure you align your hires with your culture. Bringing somebody in that doesn't fit the culture, they may have the skill set. That's hard to find somebody with the skill set you're looking for. It's even harder to find somebody with the skill set and the culture that you're looking for. But to do anything short of that, in our opinion, is just plain foolish. You're putting them in a situation that they may not be successful at, because you're bringing them into your environment. And likely you're not going to change your culture. Your culture is what it is, but you've got to understand what it is and be able to share that with others so that they can see whether that works for them. If that's a good fit, if that's a good match, that's our number one thing. Our dad used to say, you could give your competition all your standard operating procedures. You could show them your financials. You could give them all your best secrets. And that doesn't mean they'll be successful, right? And so that's the whole, that we all focus on strategy. We think the strategy is the magic bullet. And we think it's culture that's the magic bullet, because it's been shown time and time again, the strategy. Yeah, you've got to have strategy. I'm not going to say that you can do without it, but without culture, you don't have much to work with.
Okay. So biggest lessons that you have learned over the course of your career in restoration, what is or are those?
Okay. So everybody talks about diversity these days, right? And so it took us years. Growing up in the family business, we had to do certain functions. Part of it is for training. You need to learn what the jobs are and the functions and all that. But trying to find our fit in our role, I've done a lot of jobs throughout. Most every job in the company I've done, from labor to contents cleaning to everything, right? But at the end of the day, I do a couple of things really, really well. And that's what I have to focus on. And you know what? I'm not unique. My staff is the same way. They may be able to do a lot of different positions, but they probably do a few things really, really well. I say it's your gift. What is it that you bring to the organization? And you need to spend as much time as you can doing your gift in order to provide the best value for the organization as well as yourself. Because when we're doing our gift, that's when we're most fulfilled. So I'll use my son as an example. I know he won't mind this. He works for us, and part of his growing up, he had to be in different positions. He had to learn those positions. And I knew that some of the positions that he was in were not going to be ones that he would do well in or that he would gravitate towards. But there was a couple that I thought he would. I thought he was a chip off the old block. Everybody said how much he was like me, and I thought he was going to follow in my footsteps. I was wrong. And I had him in those positions, and he needed to go through those, but that wasn't where his gift was. We finally have him now running the 1-800 Board Up division. When it started, I ran that division. I think I did a pretty good job. We did pretty good with it. It was successful. But when he took it over, he took it to a whole new level. I saw the lights come on. I saw him take all the things that he had learned from the other roles and implement them in a way that I wouldn't have been able to be so successful. We were voted the top franchise in the country 3 years running. And that's all due to him. And it was finding, I'm his dad. You'd think I would know better. You'd think I would know him really well. So how do I know my employees? I can make mistakes and have them. They say, make sure you've got the right people on the bus and then they're in the right seat. I had my son in the wrong seat when I thought it was the right seat. So when you have a good employee and they're in the wrong seat or they're not performing well, they might just be because they're in the wrong seat. So we encourage staff members, if there's a position that we have available or open and you want to apply and you think that's a good fit for you, then we want you to apply for that and see, because if they're the right people, we want them on the bus, but we are most effective when we make sure that they're in the right seat. I share with my staff, because I'm a giver by nature. I want to help everybody. And there's only so much time in the day. And so I can get involved. And we always say, stay in your lane. And we don't mean that to be punitive. It's, we're a very good company in terms of helping people. That's part of our nature, our part of our culture. So if somebody in operations needs help, we shift over and we help them, but then get back in your lane, because your lane is your gift. That's what you do here. You want to be able to shift lanes to be able to help the company, but then get back in your lane so that you can provide the maximum benefit to the company. So we tell our field staff, you need to be able to operate at your level, one level lower and one level higher. So if you're a foreman, but we need you to fill in to become a superintendent, you've got to be able to fulfill that role on a temporary basis. If things slow down, you might be putting your belts back on and helping at that role. We need to be able to adapt as the company grows and expands, contracts, and we have bigger jobs or more jobs come in or a storm happen. You've got to be able to do that. And so one of the things that I tell my staff, I say that Jim does what only Jim can do. Because if I get out doing other things that other people can do, and other people can do those things better than I can. When I was working really in the throes with Xactimate, okay, I got calls from companies all across the country. I was the guy, he was the man, right? And I felt good about that. But then as the company grew and I worked less and less with that software, I realized that I was no longer the man. And so that's okay, because I had to get over that. I needed to do other things that the company needed me to do. And then somebody else at my company is now the man. And I watched these other guys and I'm like, wow, they're way faster than I ever was. You know, they're way better than I ever was. But at the time, I was the guy. And so we all have to grow and raise to a different level in order to ensure that we're fulfilling the company's needs.
Thank you. I love that additional layer there. Just even through the lens of you as an owner, like I'm sure many owners struggle sometimes with not being the master of everything and being able to appreciate, embrace, and almost like humble themselves around the fact that there are people that are so much better than you at certain things, and that's okay. So that's
what we try to, helpful. We say embrace diversity. And that, I know that's right now the really hot topic, but we learned that before. You need somebody that thinks like an accountant. And not everybody in our company is going to think like an accountant. And that's good, because we need people out there that are thinking in terms of business development, or thinking in terms of sales, or thinking in terms of operations, different mindsets that are required to do those jobs. That's great. It's bringing them together to all work cohesively and rowing in the same direction that makes the difference. And sometimes we think if somebody doesn't think like we do, that there's something wrong with them. And that's not the case at all. We need people that think differently. We need them to do their job and to take care of that part of the business for us so that we can do our own thinking. But it's getting everybody to recognize that and come together and figure out a way to integrate all of that thought into one direction that is best served for the company.
Very good. Okay, so you talked about the power of networking before and collaboration across the industry. I'm curious if there's more there or if that's the same answer, but really, what sources do you turn to for inspiration and education?
Business coaches, peer groups. You should see my iPod, my truck, all audiobooks, right? There's hardly any music on it. Always listening to that podcast, trade journal magazines. There's a lot of there's more information now than there ever was out there. But not everybody is utilizing it. So I throw my iPod in my back pocket, put my headset on, and I'll go for a walk. And while I'm exercising or walking, I get to listen to an interesting iPod or a podcast. So there's times for us to do things while I'm driving around, going from appointment to appointment. I've got it in on the truck. And so people say, I don't have time for that. Well, maybe you could carve it out. And, you know, the idea of multitasking runs rampant these days, and I'm not a huge believer, but you can walk and listen to a podcast at the same time without, you know, creating too much challenge. So I think that we just have to look for those opportunities for us. And we believe you can learn from anyone. So keep your ears open, keep your eyes open, and look for those opportunities. It doesn't have to be just within our industry. You see something, always be alert, looking for a better way or a better system or a better idea, something that resonates with you that you can bring back.
Very helpful advice. I couldn't agree more on the podcast thing. The multitasking when it comes to podcasts, you can learn so much and get so many things done that don't take too much thought. So yeah, to your point, no shortage of information at our disposal these days. Okay, so second to last question. In addition to the role you play with Restoration Affiliates, not to mention your company itself, you have and continue to participate in a number of, as I call them, extracurricular roles. So to name a few, we're talking the Institute of Real Estate Management, National Institute of Disaster Restoration, and then charities. So I'm curious what drives you to take on these additional roles and how they serve your business. How do you do it all? And what do you gain from it? And why do you do it?
So I always encourage people to get involved in something that they believed in. And that was instilled in us at a very early age. Our uncle was one of the founding fathers for St. Vincent de Paul in the Phoenix area here, which is a very large charity. And so when we were very young, we were down there at the hall, helping serve food, handing out diapers and volunteering. And so we kind of grew up with that mindset. And as I got older, I saw the importance in giving back and being a part of something larger than just yourself. And so I was on the board of UMOM New Day Centers, Arizona's largest homeless shelter here in our market. And for 9 years, I was on the board and I was a past president. And the work that we did there through that organization was phenomenal. I've been a board member of the Future Is Now Foundation, which supports many other charities as well. Been very involved with Autism Speaks. Right here, I had no idea that Phoenix was a huge market for resources for that. Didn't know much about it. Got involved, learned there's so much. So I tell people there are a lot of different opportunities. I'm involved in our state association for the apartments, Arizona Multi-Housing Association, the NAA, IRAM, things that are industry related, great. Things that are charity related, great. Just pick something, get involved. There's so many good opportunities out there. And then when you can look outside of yourself and get involved in something bigger than yourself and into a cause that's bigger than yourself, it always pays dividends and gives you back rewards and shows you that you can do things and be a part of something that you might not thought were possible without having done those things.
Very good. Thank you for that. All right. Now, last question. What is next for you and the business? What can we expect looking ahead?
So what we're focusing on is growing the leadership team. And we like the term delegate and elevate. And so it's growing the company in a sustainable way that will allow it to be continuing for generations to come. And so I say we're growing the next generation of leaders is what we're doing down there. And so it's taking that opportunity to get them to work cohesively together, get them to recognize their ability to raise above what they're doing. And it's always a challenge to grow when you're busy. It's a challenge to grow when you're slow. You take your time, you think you've got to make yourself busier, getting more busy. So there's always a challenge. There's never a good time, but it's something you constantly have to do in order to ensure that the company is going to be here for years to come. So that's our primary focus down there.
Thank you. Ending where we started with just intentionality, focus, and careful growth, purposeful growth. Very good. Okay, so I am so appreciative for this interview. I am excited to share it with the world because there are so many lessons and teachable moments throughout. I love that you shared a ton of your experiences with real examples, mistakes made. There's just a lot for us to learn from how you work and have worked and your family and business overall has operated over the years. So thank you so much, Jim.
It has been my pleasure, Valerie. I was really looking forward to having this opportunity to speak with you. I really think what you're doing and how you've jumped in with both feet is really impressive. And the energy that you're bringing to this and the interviews, the podcasts that you're putting out are just terrific. And so I really was looking forward to this and was not disappointed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate those words. And I'm excited that you're enjoying the R&R Ask the Expert podcast and the real stories as we continue forward. And literally, this is such a great case of helping others learn from how you work, truly. So before you go, my last question I always like to ask, where can listeners go to connect with you or learn more about Kowalski Construction?
Oh, thank you for that. So we've got our website, the www.kowalski.com. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. So many opportunities to connect with us out there of course, our phone number, should anybody need to get in touch with me, is another way. It's funny, that would be last, right?
Thank you so much. All right. Well, listeners and viewers, for more insights on restoration, remediation, and the people behind it all, visit our website, rmagonline.com, Apple, or Spotify. If you haven't yet, please be sure to follow the podcast. That's how you'll keep up with all of our latest episodes. And if you could give us a quick review and rating, that will help for sure. We're also on YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook, so we invite you to follow us there too. Of course, if you are interested in sharing your real story in restoration, no matter where you sit in the industry or world or your level, please reach out to me at kingbee@bnpmedia.com. This has been R&R's Real Stories in Restoration. Thank you for listening.